At the 2013 Texas Association of Magicians Annual Convention in Dallas, Texas, we had the Order of Willard Breakfast that is for members who have at least 25 years of membership within the organization. Each year we have a different speaker. This year we happen to have Arthur Emerson. And Arthur had a lot to talk about and is quite an interesting and engaging speaker. So I had my microphone on and will let you guys listen and enjoy Arthur Emerson.
And considering the room, my age and yours, and background experience, this starts in 1953 and ends in 1969, so canalize yourself there, and I think I've got this room engaged. The first one is in 53. By that time, I'm second lieutenant working in the radio company of 97th Signal Battalion, 7th Army, Stuttgart, Germany, and we're on field maneuvers out in the woods. And I've got a radio relay company, high-frequency company, big 2.5-ton trucks, 400-watt transmitters on the back end of these things, 40 of the damn things hiding in a forest. You ever try to hide 40 truck, 2.5-ton trucks? Forget it. When suddenly it's in the middle of the afternoon, and a Volkswagen bus, which they've just retired from inventory, if you saw the news recently, after 63 years, the Volkswagen bus will no longer be made. There was brand new when this thing came together, and a gentleman steps out and introduces himself as a magician by the name of Bellacchini. It's time to pause. There are 13 Bellacchinis. One of them we've had here at TAOM. His name is Rudiger Deutsch, and Rudiger Deutsch and his wife got together. He's still alive as a famous magician in Germany and a manufacturer of magnificent, extremely expensive illusions. And he decided that he was going to take all this equipment that was copies of the old days and go and put them on stage. And he and his wife got in Prussian costume and marched on stage and did a Prussian magic act called Bellacchini the 13th. In so doing, he thought it'd be fun to go find out who the hell the other 12 were. And he took this as a project and he did it. So, as a quick fill-in before we get back to the field exercise, the first guy was Samuel Belloc. And Belloc was a Polish Jew who decided he should add I-N-I to his name and become Bellacchini. That must have been very popular in those days, because a guy named Weiss did the same thing to his stage name, and they all ended up being something eeny. This particular gentleman opened up in Portugal with an illusion show, gigantic illusion show, 1840, so good that Kaiser Wilhelm I of them makes him the court magician of all of Germany. So with that as a background, along comes another guy and says, well, if he's got that name, I'll, what do you guess? I'm Bellacchini the 2nd, and then the 3rd, and the 4th, and the 5th. You've got the idea. So there were 13 of them over time. The one that I had that afternoon in 1953 was a gentleman by the stage name of Arado Bellacchini. He was Bellacchini the 7th. And his real name was William Mann. And Mr. Mann had always been a circus magician, as was everybody else in the bus. And there's four others there, and here's what he'd like to do. He'd like to exchange, if you would feed the 5 of us dinner, we'll put a show on tonight for your troops. We made the deal immediately, and off we went. If you watched MASH years ago, you know what the eating tents looked like. They were large pyramidal rectangular tents. And the cooking tent and the eating tent were side by side, like so. And you rolled up the side of the tent of one and the side of the tent of the other, put a latrine screen in the back as a scrim, and they worked the show over there, and over here was all the audience and this one, and that's how the show took place. The other four people in his company was, first of all, a husband and wife. The gentleman's name is why I write things down. It was Giuseppe Valente, and he was a circus accordion and musician. He'd been the leader of the One Ring Circus in Berlin for a number of years. His wife was a circus clown. They had with them a young couple. Erich Stolz was a juggler in the circus, and his wife, Katerina, played guitar and sang. So, we finish our field problem. We sit down to dinner. And during dinner, the elderly gentleman gets up and picks up his accordion, which is what he brought with him, and plays dinner music for us during the dinner. Okay. That was a pleasant surprise. And on comes Balakini, and he's going to do the first half of the show. We'll have an intermission, then a second half of the show after that. But I'd like to begin, and hope I see all the card routines, and we see all the billiard balls and all the rings, a pure manip act, until we get to the intermission. And the intermission, oddly enough, is the juggler. Eric Stoltz gets up and he juggles, and we had to talk to him first of all. The juggling fire clubs inside of a tent is really not a great idea. He was distraught, and we were safe, and so he had to drop that out of the act, but that's how that went. We're back to the second half. The second half will probably interest this room more than anything else. Balakini came out, and he did everything printed in U.F. Grant's Victory Carton Illusions. Anybody remember those? Of course. It was a marvel. What a great thing to have to troop with. You know, the war has only been over for 5-6 years. 47 was the armistice. This is 53. This is repatriation. The little thing that I wear on my chest is the Army occupation of Germany. So the war, as far as we are concerned, is still on. Repatriation is still on. And these guys are still trying to put the act together, and they're trying to work their way to Munich. And we'll tell you that part of the story in just a moment. But they worked all the way down the road, if they could, and encampments they'd find along the woods. And Bavaria, when we tripartited Germany at the end of the war, if you recall, the English got the north, the Americans got the south, the French got the west. So they're working their way, army by army, encampment by encampment, down toward Munich. So we get to the point where he's doing all the victory carton stuff, and done it extremely well, and now everyone is involved. All five of them are the company working on stage. And that's over. And then he introduces the little lady, and she brings out her guitar, and then she sings something called Malagena. And at that point in the game, the evening is over, and we sat down and chatted. Well, please understand, in 1955, Harry Stanley brought Di Vernon to London. Prior to that, the British had no idea what close-up magic even meant. The term had no meaning whatsoever. The two people would sit down across a table and do magic for each other. That's unheard. It's also impossible. I mean, you can't do it. You've got to stand up and have wings. You've got the message. So we sat that night, and I said, well, I tell you what, let me show you the first trick I ever learned, and I learned it when I was very, very small from the man who invented it. It was called the one-armed gambler, and you'll find it in Stars and Magic. And it was far, far from what we saw yesterday afternoon, I tell you. That presentation had nothing to do with the one-armed gambler as Vernon wrote it. In any event, I did it for Mr. Bond, and he thought, this is fascinating, fascinating. I said, now, why are you headed to Munich? He said, well, you probably know that Potsdam used to be the Hollywood of Germany. It's now in Geiselgesteig, and Geiselgesteig is a little area outside of Munich, and that's where the film industry now, and to this day, is in Germany. And we're going there because the young lady has an audition for a motion picture. She has a contract to be in a motion picture with Raymond Burr and Scott Brady called The Mannequins of Rios. It's a lovely story about white slavery. I tried to chase it down on Netflix, and believe it or not, I found it. They had changed the name for television called They Were So Young, and you can still find it on Netflix today, but the music items were so often were cut out and thrown on the casting room floor so they could fit it into a 47-minute program. So I lost that. But I did get to see that the lady got a contract, and she did a number of motion pictures after that. And as you probably guessed the ending of the story, her name is Caterina Valente. She became fairly famous. We still exchange Christmas cards. She's 81 years of age and lives in California. And if you have never heard her do Get Malagania, you've missed a marvelous evening. But anyway, this was an odd acquaintance with this guy. Comes in one night, does a one-night stand. got to see U.F. Grant, victory card and illusions, and goes off the next day down to Munich. End of snapshot number one. Snapshot number two. That number two is 1961. Some idiot decides to send me to Fort Huachuca, Arizona. Has anyone ever heard or been to Fort Huachuca, Arizona? I'm sorry to hear that. Have you been there?
Yes.
Have you? Oh, God bless you. Hour and a half south of Tucson, 15 miles from Nogales on the Mexican border, on a strip of sand that the Signal Corps, for some ungodly reason, wanted for research and development days. I was sent down there to look at some stupid project in R&D called avionics. Some dumb son of a bitch has decided we're going to take gliders, we're going to put a motor on them, and we're going to control them from the ground. All right? And this is, you know, something a Signal Corps will really love. I wrote my report up in 1.5 sheets of paper saying this. And so in any event, the only two things I got into that 3-day stay in Fort Huachuca was, first of all, I learned vodka gimlets. A marvelous find, and thoroughly enjoyed that. And I'm walking down past the Base Theater the second night, and there on the marquee it says Kalanag. I said, it can't be. Somebody has done Bellachini the 13th all over again and stolen the name. And so in I go, and it is indeed Helmut Schreiber, and Herr Schreiber has been allowed to come to this country on a State Department exchange, but he must do 3 isolated, I love this, isolated camp shows. Fort Huachuca was one of them for the 3 of you over there. We sure as hell qualified. Now the show had been greatly reduced. He had the largest show, well, let's go back a step. Helmut Schreiber, back when the headquarters for German film was in Potsdam, had already done 120 films as either actor, director, or producer of motion pictures. He'd been an amateur magician all of his life, and he met a buddy. He said, you know, we got something I think you might like to do. We're looking for a magician on an aircraft. And how would you like to take the job over? Because the guy that we hired, I'm sorry, after 1 week we fired him. So for the next 2 years, he was the magician on the Graf Zeppelin. From Germany to South America, once a month, and back again. And that's where he started doing magic every month, and decided by the time the war ends, and the film industry was not about to resuscitate rapidly, it's time to open up a magic show. And he does. And he pushed together by late 47, he has the largest magic show in all of Europe. And he troops it for years. Now, there's some good news and bad news there as far as the State Department is concerned, because they have a record of him doing the Christmas party in 1938 at Hermann Göring's home. And the boss was in the audience. And they were not too thrilled with Helmut and some of his associations in the past. But he applied, as I say, this is 1961, to the State Department to come over. The show had been greatly reduced. Gloria DeVos had for years been his wife and assistant. This great story, only in Europe can this happen. He divorces the wife, hires his mistress, and she takes the job, and both ladies work the show. I'm sorry, kids don't understand that. In any event.
That's awesome.
They were both.
Forget about it, Michael.
No, you're quite right. It was only Mae West who said, only too much of a good thing is marvelous. But even so, they are both on the show, and both very charming, and Schreiber is very interested. I don't find out until some years later at TAOM how much he appreciated anybody coming backstage that night and talking to him, because no magician in his tour would even talk to him. The Americans had shunned him entirely. They didn't want to be around him. They didn't want to talk to him. And that's how it was. And that's...
He was German.
Yeah. He was a Third Reich. And
actually, they called him a Nazi.
Oh, absolutely. So, I'm surprised that the State Department let him in. And we found out... This is 61. He's got to leave tonight to go back to Tucson. So, we can only talk for about an hour or so. He shows me the stage and the ladies. And we sit down and we chat. And he says, I don't have anything with me anymore, but here, you take that home with you and run that around the room. This is his little advertising photo.
Yeah, that's it.
But he used to love to have the cowboy hat on, and he still had the cowboy hat on in those days. And Bill, just to your front next to that blue bag is a glass. And I take a look at the glass and pass it around, because I get that glass 3 years later. Now, when he leaves Tucson, he goes to John Hopkins University. And John Hopkins is why he's in the country. He's dying of diabetes. He has 2 years left to live. He dies in 1963, back in his home in a little town outside of Stuttgart. He sells the show to Klingsor. Now, Claude Isbeck came to TAOM, lectured, and did the show years ago. And then they... wanted to know, is there someone here by the name of Arthur Emerson? And they find me and said, we have a gift for you. You were very kind to an old man. Want to send it back that way? Yes. You were very kind to an old man that he never forgot that you came backstage in some place down in Arizona and saw his show and chatted with him and he wanted you to have, when he died, in his will was to put out a memorial glass, and that's the glass. And so Claude Isbeck presents me with the glass, as you're going to see it, and it has on the bottom, you'll see his dates of birth and death. And chance encounters of people in the middle of a very odd desert in Tucson, no. Little Silver? No. Silver Springs. Sulphur Springs.
Sulphur
Springs. Gorgeous town. 23 people and a sand road. I have an idiot friend of mine who actually ran for mayor of it and became the mayor of that town when they finally incorporated it. Thought the magician had no sense whatsoever. The Klingsor show and the Kalanag show goes on to the Folies Bergère in Paris. And so the Klingsor show, and he admits that he's doing Kalanag. He's doing a crossover, admitting that the show you're going to see used to be Kalanag's show, and now I'm presenting it. And he did it at the Folies Bergère for 2 years before he dropped the Kalanag attribution and goes on as Klingsor to do one of the worst fisms we ever attended. Kalanag, incidentally, is a name that came out of Rudyard Kipling's Jungle Book. And Helmut Schreiber stole the name of the big black elephant, was Kalanag, put the A in the middle and became Kalanag, and that's the end of that story. End of the second snapshot. Third snapshot. I've got a nice cushy job. It's my last assignment before I retire after 20 years in the military. Combat Developments Command, Fort Belvoir, Virginia. The family's got house quarters. It's got it made. It's got a desk, and it's going to be quiet. Until one day. General Forsyth calls me down. He says, you know, Emerson, how the hell can we write the Army of 2000 when we don't know what the hell's going on in Vietnam? I'm going to send you over there for a year. Whoops. Thanks, Claude. I'm going to send you over there for a year as my liaison officer to General Westmoreland. So over I go. Now, please understand, when I get there, the commanding signal officer for all of Vietnam on Westmoreland's staff is a magician. If you know this gentleman, please come and tell me what you know, because I've never come across him again. Lieutenant General Thomas Matthew Rienzi, R-I-E-N-Z-I. And General Rienzi was a good friend. He would often in the afternoon pick up the phone and say, Arthur, take off your brass and we'll go out and work the hospital ship. So the USHS hospital ship Hope was docked just off the coast. And you pulled your brass and you went out there and you worked the wards or you worked whatever. And we did that three or four times. And that was great fun and very nice. And he was instrumental in getting me something that breaks the Army's first rule. Now, I was an enlisted man for a year and a half, went to OCS, got commissioned, and the second day in the military, I got the first rule. Your mouth shut, your bowels open, and never volunteer. That was it. That lasted me for 20 years, we're just fine, and until the phone rings and says, Emerson Rienzi, I want you to go to India and cut the ribbon at the first Indian Army Signal School in a town called Bhopal in the Madhya Pradesh province, and do the usual welcoming ceremonies, get drunk and go home. And I said, you know, General, that's lovely of you, sir, thank you. But I really I said, that, you don't understand. That's the site of the second All-India Magic Convention. On the same weekend. And I tell you, I'll make a deal with you. You can stay as long as you want over there on TDY. If you want to go tour around and see India, do it on me. But for God's sake, go cut the damn ribbon. Off we go. We cut the ribbon. Ron Haynes, as president of the IBM, international part of the IBM, had been to the first All India Magic Convention, and he and Ben Kleinman and their wives did the first one. And he was lobbying with them, and before Betty Joe got to do all of our Emerson and West printing on the cards, Ron Haynes did the original long runs of Color Money. And he's after me, he said, Arthur, if you're going to ever find yourself over there in Vietnam, get to India and go to that second All India Magic Congress. He says, it's marvelous. Sarkar's an amazing man. Got to go see him. And you know, it's a fat chance. My fat chance came along. I find myself flown over there, put into a gorgeous hotel. All one story, all done with rooms with patios outside in banana tree foliage. They are gorgeous. American Express, $22 a night. And that was a game. And so I finally get to go up there, and we cut the ribbon, and we drank the, since they don't drink anything except warm Coca-Cola. I haven't drank Coke in years after that experience. I'm sorry. And then we go down the site and see Sarkar coming in. Well, I got there ahead, and there was one other Caucasian beside myself in this, and he was an engineer, because Bhopal, India, is where Union Carbide had their headquarters at the time. Gary became a very famous court case. Yeah. Because we have a horrible accident that occurs in Bhopal, and don't go back there. In any event, at this time they were upgillant, they were acceptable, and so the engineer and myself are the two guys that are welcomed royally by Sarkar's staff, because he hasn't quite gotten there yet, because the attendees, and there are 125 attendees coming in by train. Now, you've all seen pictures of the train. They're hanging on the roof, the sides, the walls. When India built the train system, the government built the tracks and the cars, but not the chairs. So they sold the chairs to Scott. Now he can rent the chairs or sell the chairs out for people to sit inside the car. But the rest of it is free government property. The roof, the sides, and all the rest of it. And that's why to this day you find people riding trains in India more outside than inside. They're too cheap to buy a chair from Scott. They arrive, they set up, and their price of admission, I love this, every one of them had to get up on stage and do their best trick. That was the cost of the money to attend. And God bless this poor man. Sarkar sits in the first row for 4.5 hours. Watching 125 magicians all do their best trick. And guess what? Their best trick was a dye box. We saw 125 dye boxes done on Infinitum and Eternum. And when it was over, he finally says, we have a guest with us from America. Arthur, would you like to perform? I sat up there, all I had to do was the old Insight pen that we sold, was a magician's cueing pen. And I got to do insight, God bless. I got to do insight on stage there. And he says, I think we've had enough of this. Let's go backstage and play. P.C. Sarkar is an interesting man. He was born Prodip Chandra P.C. Sarkar, S-A-R-C-A-R. And all he did was change the A to O, so Sarkar became Sarkar. And he thought this is how it should be, and he's out there working in street dress most of his time. He's got a small problem, and I don't want to beat this one to death, but there was then, and there is to this day, a caste problem in India. There are groups that just don't work, live, eat, particularly eat, together. And he's a Bengali. And the Bengalis are now mostly from Bangladesh. But that's where he's born, that's where his son, Sarkar Jr., also P.C. Sarkar. They don't have a junior system in there. You just take father's name completely, which ought to screw up the census magnificently, particularly if they're all done. And then even. He decides that he's going to put together a magic show, and John Booth and Jack Gwynn did a lot of work in India, and John Booth sees him work, and John Booth changes his entire life. And he says, young man, you're extremely clever, but you've got to get out of street clothes and get back into national dress. Get the turban, get all the rest of it, and come out as the great Indian magician. Because let's face it, only three countries, to my knowledge, have ever owned a magician. That is to say, their salary came from the country. Keo in Russia, Silvan in Italy, and Sarkar in India. Each were government-owned. So, he puts on the costume, and we now invented TWGM. Anybody remember TWGM? The world's greatest magician, and of course. And he was a marvel at what he could do in advertising. He should have been an advertising man. He was a fine magician. He was a better inventor, and he loved to share whatever he was doing. So he said, well, we do things differently than in the States, because I went to an SAM in Chicago, and I worked there, but none of my apparatus was allowed out of customs, so everybody lent me theirs, and I've never seen such awful apparatus in my life. And he says, now let me show you how it should be done.
It was heavy.
He takes me through the entire show and explains to me that, first of all, he has three units. Barnum and Bailey had two, a blue and a red. He had three. He had blue, red, and green. They are identical except for the last illusion. The executioner's dream, the hangman, was one of them. The vanishing car was the other one. And crushing the lady was the third. Otherwise, the entire show is replicated three times. Three orchestras, three sets of assistants on stage, three lighting crews. Complete three shows. All he does is leapfrog between them, and they go up and set one and two ahead. That's quite an operation, dear friends. And I began to realize that this TWGM horse may actually be something worth listening to. He then started to show me how his apparatus operated. He says, you know, very odd, you know, I had to solve this myself. We're back to Pavel. We were talking about Pavel earlier at the table. Pavel had never had any instruction in magic, so he solved how to do it himself. So did Sarkar. His vanishing automobile is completely different than anything Steinmeier ever thought of. And it worked beautifully. He had the best black art act I've ever seen. And the best floating lady. And the lady sitting on a bench, on a rug, with her legs out in front of her, sitting upright, floating across the stage, a black art stage. Gorgeous, because she's wearing black tights and walking across the stage to a set of phony legs in front of her torso on the carpet. Sarkar has some great solutions to whatever he did. There is a book called Sarkar Magic, written in 1960. Go see if Andy Griggett's got a copy. It has every one of the things he ever invented explained in the book. The damn thing is that thick. And if you haven't seen it, you should. The best thing I saw him do in the show, he loved to do sightless vision, so they put the blindfold on and all the rest, and he had a blackboard that was only about that tall, sat on an easel, he stood behind it, and wrote upside down and backwards anything that you had written upon it in front. And that was the high point of the act, as far as I'm concerned. The high point of my 30 minutes has just ended. I thank you for listening. It's been fun to do it. Let's go watch some magic.
Well, we just finished watching the lecture by Chip Romero on Doug Henning, and he was also supplemented by Gene Anderson, who was talking about his association with Gene Anderson with Doug Henning. But I was sitting next to the president of the TAOM here this year that I'd like to introduce, Mark Jensen. Hey, Mark.
Hey, Scott. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great, and I tell you, this was just phenomenal, giving me goosebumps, you know. And I know a lot of us who remember seeing Doug Henning and growing up, you know, in that era, certainly. This just meant a lot. Now, if nothing else happens, I don't know what can top this, but I know that you got a lot of great plans.
We've got more things coming. Oh yes,
this is just too awesome. I mean, it was so unexpected. You know, the stuff I wasn't expecting. You know, Gene Anderson to be talking about this stuff and the stories he told that are not published anywhere else.
Right.
And the neat thing too is that this is the only time that he has ever or will ever present this kind of a presentation.
Correct.
Can you tell us more about that?
Well, as Chip said during the presentation, he is the owns the world's largest original Doug Henning illusion collection, mm-hmm. and a lot of the associated memorabilia that goes along with that. Mm-hmm. And Chip is very protective of it because a lot of it's very fragile equipment. Mm-hmm. He had Doug's original backdrop from his TV specials hanging, which hadn't been used in 27 years.
That's huge back then.
And, you know, he likes to keep it in the protected environment of his private museum.
Right.
But he's also one of my best friends, and when we were putting together this event, I called him up, and a little arm twisting, and he said, for you, Mark, I'll do it, first and last time ever, which actually created our theme for this convention this weekend was, hey, if we've got one first and last time ever, let's try to do some others. And so
some of the things are planned that are first and last?
In fact, at 1:30 today is an event called the President's Surprise, which is the first time ever at a convention. I will honestly say it's been done once before for about 40 people.
Yeah.
And it'll never be repeated again.
Hmm.
So
I think about
looking
eating
forward to that.
Think about eating a peanut. You open a peanut, it's the first time it's ever been seen, you eat it, that's the last time I'll ever be seen.
Well, this is a little more special than a peanut. Because, you know, it's the president's surprise, but...
And that's yours.
Yeah, that's me. But the way I've kind of teased it is I've said, within the first minute, everyone in the audience will be going along with me going, me too.
Okay, wow.
You know, so, I mean, it's got it.
I am teased.
The surprise has a connection to
everybody
here.
Yeah, interesting. And so that's not to be missed, and we'll talk about that, I guess, then afterwards and find out what that, that surprise was. I'm anxious. And next we have Gene Anderson, who's going to be talking about.
Gene's doing what he calls Gene Anderson Unpublished. Okay. And Gene is writing a book right now, which has both, you know, his classic favorites, you know, the torn and restored newspaper, but with some handling and historical information that he's discovered that has never been released before.
Yeah.
He has brand new material. You know, remember during the Doug Henning thing, he mentioned the thread?
Right.
That's going to be in the book.
Oh, he's going to talk about that. Okay.
Right, and those type of things. So, you know, it's really fun to get that preview of the book that he's writing.
Right. I know he's been working on that for a long time, just as Walter Blaney. These guys have got these ideas and these books, and so I'm anxious for these to finally come out then, too. And so, first and last time, and I know we've got then Tom Mollica doing Duke.
Yes, Tom, when he had the tomfoolery, he closed his show with Duke, which is a vent act, and he has not performed Duke in over 25 years. And so for the first time in over 25 years and the last time ever, he'll be performing Duke. And I can honestly say it's the last time because he no longer owns Duke.
Whose collection is that in now?
It happens to be in Chip Romero's collection, my buddy once again.
Okay.
And it's funny how that came about because, you know, Chip bought the original Mollica wallet.
Okay.
And he paid an armload for it, but he wanted to have it.
Yeah.
And Tom was so impressed by that that later he decided he was willing to sell Duke. And, you know, he called Chip up saying, hey, would you be interested? Well, Chip called me. We talked about it. And I said, hey, I think it would be a perfect addition to your, you know, collection. Because he also purchased
the pool
Tom,
cue? Did he buy his pool cue?
No, he didn't get the pool cue, but he got Tom's original close-up case.
Oh.
With all his...
I remember, yes, he did.
Everything
buy
he had. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so, Chip and I, after Chip received Duke, you know, he sent me a picture of it, and we're on the phone talking, and... You know, I go, man, that is so cool. You need to bring it to TAOM so I can look at it.
Yeah.
You know, so I can play with it. And he goes, well, you know, Tom's going to be there. Wouldn't it be cool if we could get Tom to perform Duke again?
Yeah.
So I said, well, hold on. And I hung up on him. I called Tom and goes, that sounds fun. So Sunday night at the Guest of Honor event, Tom will be performing Duke.
Oh, cool. And Harry Anderson's going to be doing something first and last, too, I assume?
Yeah, Harry Anderson is here, and he is the Magic Castle, you know, Academy of Magical Arts, 2012 Lecturer of the Year.
Mm-hmm.
And so he is going to be, you know, giving his lecture, which he rarely does now because he's actually starting to do a lot more work in Hollywood again and
Oh, he is? Okay, good. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he may be involved in a little special thing here or there. You know, one of the things, you know, that... You know, I love Magic Live. You know, I've been to everyone.
Yeah.
And even though, you know, Stan started to kind of let some of the stuff out, it's the surprises that are fun.
Absolutely.
When you walk into a room and you go, whoa, I'm really glad I'm here.
You're right.
And we've tried to also, you know, keep a few secrets back to have people going, that was cool.
Well, one of the secrets that he had was the big secret at the end of Magic Live where the Johnny and Pam Thompson did the Great Thompsonian Company for the last time.
Correct.
And so, but they're here.
Yeah, they are here, and they have what I call a brand new classical act.
Okay.
And it's what I call, it's new old stock. I mean, it's things that they used to do years and years ago.
Yeah, but they're reviving this.
Right, and they're reviving it, but let me tell you, there will be some dove work that you won't believe. Things that Johnny has kind of kept to himself that you will see him perform tonight, in fact, so...
Great.
He's on tonight's show.
Good. Well, this has just been the culmination of, I know, more than a year. It's been a lifetime, you know, kind of different contacts and friends and things that you have made, of course, to kind of come together to make this just such a special convention. And I understand we have like over 500 or so registrants, have you heard recently?
As of yesterday, we had about 530, 540 registrants, mm-hmm. plus, you know, a few people who could only attend for the single day.
Yeah, single days.
And our show tonight is sold out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so every seat is filled. We have a few public tickets left for, you know, tomorrow night's show, which is the All Texas show, which would be really great. We're kind of, you know, we've rolled the dice on a few things, doing things a little differently.
Yeah.
First, our host for tonight's show, which is the Comedy Magic Showdown, is Tom Mulica.
Yeah.
Who better than stand there and entertain you, telling stories and jokes between the acts?
Yeah.
Tomorrow night, our host is Burton Gilliam, who is a major motion picture star, starred in over 50 movies, most well-known for Blazing Saddles, mm-hmm. Back to the Future 3 and such. And it's the all-Texas show, so every performer on there is from Texas.
And Baldwin? It's not Stephen Baldwin, but what was that the other?
Daniel Baldwin.
Daniel Baldwin's coming in.
He's coming in. We have a special event, once again, first time ever, never to be repeated, tomorrow, Sunday at noon, which is Magic Movies and a Cast of Characters.
Yeah.
David McGee, who just had a very nice write-up in the September issue of Magic Magazine is going to be the host of that, and we have Tom Mulica on it talking about characters. You may not know it, but Tom had a role in Finding Forrester.
No, I did not know that.
So, you know, he's going to talk some about, you know, the experience of doing that movies. From the magical consulting arena and, you know, also performing magic on TV and such, we got Johnny Thompson.
Mm-hmm.
Burton Gilliam will be there to talk, you know, I mean, if somebody wants to know, hey, I want to do movies, do I need an agent?
Right.
Or when do I get an agent? You're going to get years and years worth of experience telling you what you need. And Daniel Baldwin is coming in. He's just finished filming a new film that he produced and acted in here in Texas. And he'll be talking about that and answering questions about, you know, what it takes to really succeed if, you know, you want to, or you're just curious how things work really in Hollywood.
Wow. That should be phenomenal. And everything sounds so exciting. And I know some people who are listening to this, it's not too late. You know, you can still come. There's going to be stuff going on all day on Sunday and then on Monday as well. We got still lectures up until Monday noonish or what?
We had such a great talent lineup. There are no dead periods.
That's true.
I mean, Friday, our opening lecture was Alan Okawa,
an
underground legend that for those who saw him,
you
know, they're like, I'm glad I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
Monday morning, Rob Zabrecki, the Magic Castle 2011 and 2012 Stage Magician of the Year, and he happens to be the closing act for tonight's Comedy Magic Show.
Yeah.
And David Stone, who, well, you know, if you know David Stone, you know that's going to be a fantastic, yeah, fun lecture.
So, I think tomorrow's Fielding West lecture.
Yeah,
or something.
Fielding West, yeah, is Sunday morning.
Yeah. What a stellar lineup.
Oh, I mean, you know, I'm so proud of it. And you mentioned, you know, this has been in the works for years. Well, in 2006, I was the talent chairman for, you know, TAOM here in Dallas. And I started a notebook of ideas and things that, you know, after that. And, you know, I booked all the talent for the convention. And to be honest, I started calling friends saying, hey, you want to come party with us in Dallas?
Sure.
And, you know, it started coming together. And then I looked at people that I would like to become friends with. And,
sure,
you know, we're all here now.
Worked out great. Well, thank you. You're doing a great job. And you seem very relaxed for someone who's running every place. And I'm glad you've got a couple of minutes that you gave us here.
Oh, I'd like to just add one other thing. We are supporting two charities during the convention this weekend. It started with the event last night, which was the Magic at the Midway.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, everyone who attended got tickets to play the games.
And that was interesting that you did not have an evening stage show, that instead of a Friday night show, that everyone got to go to the Midway and play the games and all that.
And you know, I'll tell you honestly, that was another one of those rolls of the dice. But the reason I wanted to do that is I've always, you know, Friday, a lot of people have to work.
Yeah.
And they can't get here in time to be able to either get the registration and the show's already started.
Mm-hmm.
So what we did was a 7 to 10, essentially, come and go as you please. So if you wanted to go out, you know, you got flew in late, you wanted to do dinner, you could go to the Midway at 8:30, still have fun, enjoy yourself.
Right.
And at least from what everyone's told me, they had a good time at it and
it was
enjoyed
fun.
It.
And then they had Larry Haas lectures at 8:30, and then the later one with Bruce Wall said about the games, yeah, you can't win kind of thing.
And I thought that was perfect timing for Bruce, even though it was late. It was after people had played all those games,
yeah,
and going, well, how come they win all the time and,
yeah,
I don't?
Right.
And
right,
he explained why they don't.
So the charities, you were saying.
Right. We're supporting the Alzheimer's Association, which has a very close connection for the Dallas local host club.
Mm-hmm.
One of our life members, Bob Carlback, who passed away last,
right,
year,
mm-hmm,
had Alzheimer's. Several of our club members have family members and such who suffer from, mm-hmm, that illness. And, you know, I have personal friends in the Magic community. You know, Marshall Brodeen.
Right,
you know,
and Marshall's here.
Yeah, Marshall Brodeen is here.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that felt like a very natural fit. And then the Ronald McDonald House. I know Ronald McDonald personally,
yes,
and I
know,
have worked several charity events with him at the Ronald McDonald,
yeah,
House, and so I felt that was a good mix.
Mm-hmm.
We raised funds for them last night at the Midway event.
Mm-hmm.
When people ran out of tickets, they could get four for a dollar. Every dollar went, and we raised just short of $200 just last night. So
in ticket sales.
Yeah, mm-hmm. $200,
yeah,
you know, buying four tickets at a time. Tonight, after the evening show, there will be an intermission of about 15 minutes or so, and then we have a charity auction. We have about 30 items we're going to be auctioning off. They're both real cool Magic things and celebrity items. For example, Carl Weathers, who was Apollo Creed in the Rocky movies,
right,
sent us a pair of boxing gloves. And the really cool thing about these is if you walk up to him, see him in a restaurant, and go, Mr. Weathers, I happen to have some boxing gloves,
yeah,
with me.
You
would
sign,
you sign,
yeah,
them? He'll sign them. He'll put Apollo Creed on them. But he will not put any inscriptions on them.
Mm-hmm.
He put his most famous lines from the movie.
Hmm.
There ain't going to be no rematch.
Yeah.
And such on these boxing gloves. We have an original Blazing Saddles script signed by Mel Brooks.
Wow.
And on the Magic side, we have a Matt King Cloak of Invisibility.
Mm-hmm.
We've got Lance Burton sent us a bunch of stuff. We've got the Ultimate Johnny Thompson collection. I mean, it's just going to be a lot of fun, and we hope,
wow,
we raise a lot of money for the charities tonight.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Mark. I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you for asking.
You're welcome. Good luck with the rest of the convention. And for those of you who hear this, get on here to Dallas. This is the place to be. And this is the one of the biggest conventions of the year. And you can be a part of it, and some of history as well. So that was Mark Jensen, president of the Texas Association of Magicians for 2013. And this is Scotty out. I want to ask Russell. So Scott Welsh for the Magic Word, and I just got Walter Blaney and Russell Bruce over here. Walter, you're just saying what? Did it again?
Well, it's just my story about Blackstone Sr. being my idol that got me into show business,
right,
and into magic, really, and made me want to be a professional. And I just loved the show. Mark Wilson and I were friends, and we could see our show between the movies at the Majestic Theater in Dallas when,
right,
we were 9 years old, right, and 11 and 13. Every 2 years, we'd come back. So Mark and I probably saw him 50 different shows.
Oh. Different shows, wow.
Yeah, over a period of about 6 years.
Yeah.
We would go Monday through Saturday. We'd see the first three shows and watch the movie and then do our homework between. And then we had to leave for the before the fourth show.
Right.
So you add that times, that's 18 shows a week, I guess, for 2 weeks when he was there for 6 or 7 years. Anyway, we saw about 50 shows each, and we loved him. But anyway, the point was I finally got to see him near the end of his career do his hour show in a theater, a movie theater, in Waco, Texas. Mm-hmm. And I went around the back of the theater where he was out on the fire escape, more or less.
Yeah.
And I said, could I shake your hand? You're my idol, Mr. Blackstone. I'm Walter Blaney. I'm just a young magician. Making it my profession. And this is my wife, Joyce. And so I shook hands with him. He said, oh, God, oh, ow, ow, ow. Damn Texans. And he was in a really bad mood.
Yeah.
And he had arthritis, and I didn't know that. And maybe I was a little exuberant, but I don't like people that squeeze
when,
yeah, I don't like that. I just was shaking hands, but it was enough to where it kind of hurt
him.
Caused
pain. Yeah.
Yeah, and he didn't know me, and then he realized he really kind of made me sad. And I said, but you're my idol, you know. And he said, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I didn't mean to hurt you.
I'm just a bit, things are bad right now, and the damn audiences are small, and, you know, he was just in a, out of sorts.
What year would that have been?
Oh, gosh, 1952 probably, mm-hmm. just shortly after we were married in 1950.
Yeah.
And we were just trying to get into the business. But anyway, that was kind of a disappointment. But later I got to meet him at the Magic Castle and talk to him at length, and we became friends. I don't know if you remember me.
Did you ever tell him that story? Oh, you're the guy who hurt my hand.
yeah, I didn't. I didn't bring that up.
Yeah, good.
Probably, it just slipped my mind.
Exactly.
But that was a terrible first meeting of him.
Well, I wanted to ask Russell also, because some of you may not know that Russell had worked with Siegfried and Roy up till the very end. How did you first meet them? Talking about, you know, him meeting his idol, Harry Blackstone Sr. How did you actually meet those guys? You were their prop manager, weren't you?
No, not their manager. I worked for the props. We're in the props
department. Okay.
I didn't want to work a magic show. I'd gotten tired of it from.
Yeah, because you were doing full-time magic in Houston way back.
Well,
when.
No, it was working with Kirby for 10 years.
Yep.
Because I ran
Kirby Van Birch. Yeah.
So then I came back to Las Vegas. I wanted to work for Cirque du Soleil at Treasure Island, mm-hmm. at the Mystère show, and so I put in my application there. Well. The Siegfried and Roy show called me about 2 weeks later, and I said, I didn't give you guys a resume. He goes, oh, we share with Treasure Island. I was like, oh, okay. And so, I don't know, they set up an interview. I came in, and I got a job.
You talked to them directly, or did you talk to their agent?
No.
Or how they...
no, their stage manager.
Yeah.
No, in fact, I had been told by friends of mine, Siegfried and Roy do not want you here. Because of my association with Kirby.
Because of Kirby?
Kirby and the fact that I have a magical background.
Right.
They don't want people with a magical background. And so that's why I never even bothered giving them my application. So when I got the call, if it was from a lady named Lori Culhane, who was the stage manager, I figured, you know, they probably haven't read very closely my resume.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't see Kirby on there. So I'm going to at least get a backstage look.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to go in for the interview. And so I went in for the interview. As I'm walking into the office, the head of all the departments has my a copy of my resume. So I'm like, well, they've obviously seen Kirby because I can read it from here.
Yeah.
And so I sit down and interview with them. We talk about some illusions and stuff. And they're like, well, do you have any questions? It's like, yeah. And I said, what? I said, can I go see the dragon? And everyone kind of had this panicked look as they look around the room and goes, it's in storage right now for the show, so no. I was like, oh, okay.
They thought you were going to go and steal some ideas or something?
I don't know what they thought.
Yeah.
It certainly flipped them out, though,
Yeah. And
which is what I wanted to do anyway because I was there to have fun.
Well, did they hire you on the spot or say,
no.
We'll call you back, or what was the deal?
I said, well, thank you very much for coming in. We appreciate it. Well, I called a friend of mine who works there. I said, hey, Frank, I interviewed at SNR. He goes, yeah, I heard about it. In fact, I saw you come in. We were doing presets. I was like, you know, I'm afraid I got it. And he's like, what? I said, well, I don't want to work a magic show. I'm pretty burned out with Kirby. And he goes, do you have any other offers? It's like, No. He says, I think I'd take it.
That's a good point. In Las Vegas, there are a lot of other people looking for work, too.
Exactly.
Yeah. And what year would that have been?
That was 97.
Okay.
So, what are you looking for?
Just stories. Will you tell me a couple of good ones?
Actually, if you want a story, let me pick one. I got jillions. There's a back area in behind the theater. Everybody goes out there to smoke, drink Cokes, whatever, just chit-chat. Show's usually all preset.
Yeah.
We're all just hanging out there. Siegfried drives up, and he parks over on the curb in this little back area, and he gets out of his car, and he's just shaking his head, and everybody's just like, okay, what's going on? And as he gets closer, we suddenly start hearing him goes, I don't get it. I just don't get it. And everybody's like, What is this, Siegfried? I don't get it. And it's like, give me a cigarette. And he lights it. So as he sits there smoking, he's like, I can't believe it. And everybody's like, well, Siegfried, are you going to tell us or what's going on?
Yeah.
And he says, well, I was driving on the way into work, and I realized I doesn't have any cigarettes. And so I look up ahead, and there's a stop and go, and so I pull in to get some cigarettes. I go inside, I grab the cigarettes, I put some on the counter, and I suddenly realize I doesn't have my wallet with me. I left it at home. And so I told the lady, I'm going to take the cigarettes to the theater. I will send somebody back with some money. She snatched them out of my hand. I can't believe it. I said, do you know who I am? I am Siegfried of Siegfried and Roy. And she looks at me and says, I am Bernice of 7-Eleven, and you don't get the cigarettes.
That's a good one. That's a great story.
It is a great story.
He's actually a very funny guy. I had to piece this one together by talking to different people in different departments.
Yeah.
Siegfried goes rushing into wardrobe and goes, Michelle, I need a pair of dentures. And she's like,
dentures?
I can't give you my dentures. And he goes, no, I don't want your dentures. You have some old dentures, maybe. And he goes, she opens up a drawer and goes, oh, I have these, but they're broken in half. She goes, I'll take some. And he goes running off.
Wow.
And everyone in wardrobe's like, what was that about? I'm in props. So he comes marching into the props department, goes up to a friend of mine there, and goes, Antonio, I need you to glue these back together. And Antonio looks at him and goes, Siegfried, if I glue these back together, you're not going to be able to use them. He goes, I don't wear dentures! So just glue them together. And so he does like 5-minute epoxy, gets them all glued together, and he says, okay, that'll hold for a while. It's probably not going to hold. That's fine. And he runs off with them. And again, we're all just like, does anybody get this? So now I'm going to have to give some backstory. The opening of the show as it normally runs, I am standing upstage in between two hydraulic units called A-frames. They are a set of stairs that go up to the geode illusions, which Siegfried and Roy appear at the top of the show. I'm standing there holding a trick line for a set piece that's going to come after that. The traditional opening of the show, there's a dance number going on stage. Siegfried and Roy come over. They stand at the base of their assorted stairs with their dressers. Siegfried's sitting there chewing his gum, and they're waiting for some certain point in the show. I think it's a musical cue. The dresser, Keith, pulls out a napkin. Siegfried reaches over, grabs it. He spits the gum out. He hands it back to Keith. And then Keith lights his way up the steps. Mm-hmm. And he gets in the illusion, and Keith just disappears. That's what normally happens during the run of the show. I'm standing there with my little string. Siegfried and Roy come over. Siegfried's standing there chewing on his gum. And I happen to glance down, and I see the teeth in his hand. I'm like, okay, whatever it is, it's about to happen. And so I'm just like, all right, so what's the scam? What's going to go on? He's sitting there chewing his gum, and then Keith holds up the napkin. He takes the napkin, spits out the gum, and I watch him drop the teeth into the napkin and then hands it back to Keith. And Keith You know, he's doing this with a flashlight. He's lighting Siegfried's way up the steps. Siegfried gets about 6 or 7 steps up there and turns around, wraps his gums around his teeth, and goes, "Keith, my teeth!" Keith looks down at his hands like,
sees that gum in the teeth.
Yes. That was one of my favorite moments there.
That is funny. Well, one thing I do have to ask you about, tell me about the last day and how that all came down and what happened and all that.
Well, I can't tell you that much because I didn't see anything.
You were backstage?
Yeah.
You just heard about it?
Happened is we had just done the illusion called Sirmody, which is basically things that go bump in the night.
All right.
We're putting away the illusion back in the prop room. And when you run a show for a long period of time, when the music isn't playing or it's not playing the right volume or I don't know how to describe it, you just instantly everybody just stop and there's something wrong. The music is not playing where it normally is. Somebody's not saying something. Mm-hmm. It was just silent. Well, back there, the one thing you're told is do not ever run. If there's a loose cat and they see you running, it becomes a game. It's like, oh, let's play.
Yeah.
And so we're all just standing in the prop room. Suddenly a guy comes running back and says, "Does anyone have a medical kit back here?" And so we're like, okay, Siegfried got bit. And so we hand him the medical kit. We continue putting the illusions away. And then I walk out and hear Roy's gotten bit. And I'm like, all right, we're finished for tonight. And so I went and helped the animal crew get the cages. There's transport cages scattered all over the stage with cats in them. And so I figured they're going to need help. Roy has like a huge group. There's like 15, 20 people around Roy. I couldn't even see him. And so I went and helped the animal guys get the cats.
And the people had exited the theater, I guess, at that point?
They're still there.
Oh, and the audience, yeah.
Because Siegfried just sat there and he was stunned, wide-eyed, just staring.
Gushing blood?
Well, Siegfried's okay.
No, I mean Roy, I'm sorry.
I guess.
So you just see Siegfried just standing there.
Siegfried's okay. Standing, and the crew is around Roy, because everybody has like their fingers or fists in whatever orifice is pouring blood out.
Right, right. But
like I said, I didn't see any of this. I'm just trying to help the animal guys get the cats back in, because I know it has to be done, and no one else is helping them. And then I think the last thing I saw was Roy being taken out on a gurney and yelling, "Don't kill the cat."
So he could still speak as he was leaving the stage.
Yeah, it was gargled because the cat had punctured the carotid artery, and then there's an artery that goes down the center of the backbone with a cluster of nerves. I think it's called a pulmonary artery, and he had also nicked that too.
Mm.
So... that's my.
So do you still keep up with Siegfried and Roy? I mean, have you seen Roy, or what's the status, or health today?
Last time I saw them, I was invited to be part of the crew for their last performance at the Bellagio, which I took time off from our show at Ka to go over and do that, just because we needed that closure.
Yeah, because after that you did go to work for Circus Line. You went to work at Ka.
Yeah. Because immediately after, let's see, Roy was bitten on the 3rd of October, and the next Sunday, it was like a couple of days.
What year was that?
03.
Okay.
We were brought in by Mirage Management, and basically the opening statement was, "Ladies and gentlemen, the show is closed. There will be no more Siegfried and Roy show." And this was to everybody. There's like 400 or 500 people there, because it was dancers, it was crew, it was ticket people, it was waiters, waitresses, everybody. Mm-hmm. Anybody who had anything to do with that show was let go immediately.
Were they four-walling that?
You know, I don't know.
That's one of his, like, you know, Penn & Teller and Matt King and those kinds of
things. I think there was some type of contract with the hotel, because even though we were let go, there was a group of 20 of us that were rehired almost immediately. I think it was the next month, to load the show out. And they were in no
rush. Into storage, which is someplace still in storage, I guess?
A lot of it is. It's at their estate. Mm-hmm. But there was no rush. We took about 8 months to load that show out.
Yeah, because they didn't know who they were going to put in this place.
No, I think it was insurance-based.
Oh, as okay.
Because the Illusions were not allowed to leave the theater. We ripped everything out of the floor. We took all the Illusions. We put them on pallets. We plastic wrapped them.
Right.
All in from any piece that went to that Illusion came together and was palleted and all white, you know, cabled down and just ready for a forklift to pick it up and take it to a truck to send it to their warehouse. But it was not allowed to leave the building. It had to stay there. And at the end of that 8 months, suddenly it was like, get this crap out of here.
Now. Yeah.
It's like, what are you wasting our time for?
Wow.
And the only thing we thought, they probably had an insurance thing like through Lloyd's of London, that every time they didn't do a show, they were the hotel and the estate, SNR estate, was paid money for it.
Right.
So I'm guessing at the end of that 8 months, the insurance had probably gone up. And so
I
then,
gotcha.
And then it was like, okay.
Next show.
Next. Yeah. Get them out.
Yeah.
So.
But you said that he was, they were good, and you had gone out afterwards and had visited with him from time to time, or did you ever?
No, I never did any of that. Because we weren't that close.
Mm-hmm.
We were close enough that I could go to their dressing room and ask them about anything. There was a fear backstage, even up in management. No one wanted to talk to Siegfried or Roy. And
before the show or after the show? Or
during the show or any time.
Oh, really?
It was like, that was your goal in life, is not to ever have to talk to Siegfried or Roy.
Wow.
And I...
Because everyone else, I thought, from the public are clamoring to get into their... they have like 2,000 square feet dressing room or something huge, I'd heard.
Oh, yeah, the thing upstairs?
Yeah.
It was huge. No, they would have parties up there all the time.
But under people show on the staff didn't like...
Under show conditions, you did not want to ever be associated with them. It was because they'd go nuts and yell at you. And who really wants to have somebody yelling at you? So, but the trouble is, it bred a very bad situation. If there was something wrong with an Illusion, Siegfried would tell his dresser. Keith would tell stage management. Stage management would come to the head of the department. The head of the department would go to whatever individual in that department would go work on it and fix it.
Deal with it.
Well, if you've ever played the game Telephone...
By the time it gets there,
it's... Yeah. Okay, so I get a message from my boss, Joe. It's like, and he comes up with a little slip of paper, says, Russell, go check Siegfried's getaway slide. It's like, for what?
Yeah.
And he's like, well, just check it over. I was like, Joe, come on. Give me a hint. What am I looking for? And he says, just check it over. And I was like, thank you, Joe. And so I just walked out, and I was like, what the hell? I went up to Siegfried's dressing room. I said, Siegfried, I just got a really cryptic message about your getaway slide. You said something was wrong with it. And he's like, oh, let me see. What was that? Oh, there's a screw or a nail. It's grabbing my costume at the shoulder. It's like, no problem. I'll take care of it. Won't happen next show. That was easy.
Yeah.
It's like all somebody had to do was that, but no one really wanted to go talk to them because they didn't want to be yelled at.
Interesting.
So.
Fun. Well, interesting stories. Thank you very much. A lot of good insight over there. Appreciate that, Russell. By the way, the title of my podcast is called The Magic Word. So I've had one from Walter before, I think, but what is your magic word? Wouldn't have to be like abracadabra. What is your motto, your life chi? What is you live by? What's important to you?
Do we eat tonight?
Well, advice you gave me before, did they pay you? Well, then it must have been a good show. Did you get your check? What do you think?
I don't have anything.
No word? Nothing that comes to mind? Or a phrase? Or
have a good
model
time.
Slogan? Have a good time. In life, that's important.
Yes.
A good time.
Yeah.
And you're having a good time. You're enjoying your job over at Ka?
Yeah.
Good. How many years have you been there now? 10 years?
I think... 8 to 9, somewhere in there. I'm not sure because the show's been open, I think, for 9. And I don't know, but we were there before the show ever opened.
Russell Bruce and Walter Blaney, thank you guys very much. And
pleasure.
For now, Scotty Wells. This is Scotty out. All right. right, well, we're about ready for the evening show, and I got first wife, I should say first lady, and the president of the International Brotherhood of Magicians, Mr. Bill Evans and Pam. Hey, guys, how are you?
Hey, great.
So we were just talking about the TOM, and this is, Pam, you said your first TOM that you've been to. Bill, you've been to the TOM.
No, it's
you haven't either.
Too.
So both of you guys, what are you thinking of this?
It won't be my last, that's for sure.
You're going to come back.
Absolutely.
And you were saying, Pam?
Absolutely. I definitely would love to see it again. I've loved everything that I've seen today,
yep,
and yesterday, and probably, and tomorrow I know is a big day. So.
Right. Yeah, we've got so much more still planned. Well, you've been to Dallas before, but never really to, you know, the TOM convention. So.
Oh, absolutely. I went to SMU, so I've been to Dallas, you know,
of course,
before.
Yeah.
But it's very enjoyable. Mark has just done a tremendous job.
Yeah.
And everything is just, you know, everything's just been incredible.
Well, you're kind of on the convention tour then right now. Of course,
absolutely.
We had a great convention in Phoenix. I thought the IBM was just this is one of the better conventions, you know, this year in Phoenix. And then when you were inducted as president, and then we had the Magic Live. That was a fantastic Magic Live convention.
Incredible.
And
yeah.
Pam, you enjoyed it, Magic Live in Vegas, I guess, then,
too? I did not go.
I remember Bill being there. I don't remember
right,
seeing you. That's right. That wasn't you by his side. I'm sorry. Never mind. We'll forget about that. That was my wife. No, she wasn't there either. But that was a good convention. And then you got, what's your next convention? Where do you go from here?
British Ring.
Okay.
And going over there for the British Ring Convention, then the London, we're going to the Magic Circle, and come back and regroup. But
okay.
I'm really happy to be here. Looking forward to tomorrow as well. My good friend Tom Mullica, you know, it's such a great thing to be here for him.
Yep. Johnny Thompson going to be on the
absolutely
show tonight, you know.
Absolutely.
And, gosh, so many people that have been here in Fielding West, and oh golly, it's going on and on and on.
Fielding's one of my favorites.
Yes, very funny. I think he's lecturing tomorrow, I believe.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
Yeah, should be fun. So, well, good. Just one last thing. What have you got planned for your presidency? What is your, it's going to be going around and spreading goodwill and cheer, I guess?
Well, I hope so. I hope so. It's better than, you know, spreading doom and gloom.
But you're going to see as many rings as you can?
As many as I can. I'm trying to visit the local rings and then trying to visit the faraway ones as I can, too. We've got some definite plans, and we've got some indefinite plans. You know, I'm but hoping to do as much as I can.
Hard to coordinate with a full-time professional law career. I mean, how are you getting around all
I have great partners.
You must have. It's not like you're retired, you know.
That's right.
You kind of got that J-O-B thing going.
That's right.
On the other side. Well, good. Thank you guys very much. And,
thank you, Scott.
For enjoying the convention.
Good
best
to see
luck you. To you. You bet.
Thank you.
That was Bill and Pam Evans for the Magic Court. Scotty out. Thank you.